This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Good morning. You're listening to APA Compass, the Pacific Northwest's only Asian Pacific American public affairs radio program. I'm Kushlani D'Souza, and in recognition of International Women's Day, we're focusing today's program on gendered violence, a difficult but important topic that could be triggering for some listeners who are violent survivors or their advocates. Today, Sarika Mehta talks with former APA Compass Collective member Patty Duncan about her film Finding Face and Acid Violence. I'll be talking with anthropologist Pinky Hota about the media coverage surrounding the highly publicized Delhi rape incident. And first, you'll hear Andrew Yeh's interview with Sonia Falero, who also discusses the Delhi case, as well as her latest book, Beautiful Thing, Inside the Secret World of Bombay's Dance Bars.
Thanks for listening to APA Compass today. I'm Andrew Yeh, and on today's show, we have Sonia Falero, the author of Beautiful Thing, Inside the Secret World of Bombay's Dance Bars. The book has won accolades on Books of the Year lists from The Economist, The Guardian, and The Sunday Times, among others. Sonia herself is the recipient of a CNN Young Journalists Award. We'll speak today with her about her book and about the recent social uprising around women and violence in India. Sonia begins by telling us what life was like for the dancers in Mumbai's now-defunct dance bars.
So essentially, you know, a dance bar in Bombay used to be, it's been banned now, but it was essentially a seedy little bar with a stage in the middle, and these women, groups of women, anything from 12 to 25 women, dressed fully in saris, would dance to Bollywood music. They would gyrate for hours. It was incredibly exhausting work, and they would start about 7 in the evening, go on till 1 in the morning perhaps. And the men in the sort of old royal tradition would show their appreciation for these dancing girls by throwing money on them. But they weren't allowed to actually approach these young women. They were not allowed to touch them, far from that. So they would either throw the money or the money would be given to a steward and he would later on hand it to these young women. So for a lot of people and also for the bar dancers, what they did was a form of prostitution, because eventually they did enter into sexual relationships with customers for money or other gifts. But because they could support themselves entirely from bar dancing, they were not entirely prostitutes, and they were at the top of this chain of women who, you know, whether on occasion or otherwise, slept with men for money. But as a result of the things they went through, they developed addiction. They were ostracized from their communities, even though their money helped support their families and ensure that, you know, the other young women in their families didn't end up in the dance bar. Some of these women came from castes where young women traditionally enter into the entertainment profession, you know, such as a circus or performing on the street, or traditionally perform sex work. But many more women had escaped abusive families, and they were illiterate and they were very young when they ran away. And the dance bar was really was offered them economic independence that would have been out of the question if they had remained in their families or back home in their villages or small towns. So in a way, it allowed them to be free and allowed them to be independent, while simultaneously shackling them to the dance bar and the customers. It was a really fascinating story to pursue because these women were survivors and incredibly tough. And what happened in 2005 was that the state government of Maharashtra, of which Bombay is the capital, really didn't have any more excuses to offer as to why Bombay, which is, you know, once an economic powerhouse, was really not doing very well economically. And so one bright politician came up with the idea of suddenly talking about how, well, if nothing else, at least we are protecting the morality of our city. And this sounds like something out of a film, but it actually happened. He declared that if he shut down the dance bars and essentially threw these 75,000 women out onto the street, then Bombay would be a more moral city. It would be a crime-free city. This was a statement that came completely out of the blue. It was just senseless, and it's never been done before. And within just a few months, these bars were shut down, and these women were out in the streets. And so you had this tradition, this entertainment industry that had flourished in the city for years, that was demonized, and women who were blamed for being immoral were pushed into various forms of prostitution and extremely violent forms, in fact. And, you know, the repercussions were, as you can imagine, terrible.
So you mentioned there are 75,000 women that were involved before 2005, but there's also a whole infrastructure around that, pimps taking their cuts and police officers taking bribes, housewives renting out the rooms in their houses and so on. How large was this total infrastructure?
You know, it's really not that easy to say because, first of all, the sizes of the bars really varied. You know, you could have one bar with just four or five girls and a couple of stewards and a manager and a boss. But then you could have these other dance bars that were three or four stories high with hundreds of girls dancing. And supporting these girls were people not just within the dance bar, as you point out, but outside. So, you know, you had the cabs that had been specially, you know, that would drop them and pick them up from work every single evening. That was their only job. You had the tailors who would make these women all their dazzling clothes. You had the small artisans who were responsible for providing them with this very real-looking gold jewelry, all of which was, of course, completely fake. Then you had the various madams, the pimps, layer upon layer of people who depended on the dance bar. So the girls were the face of the dance bar, but they were really not the primary beneficiary. The primary beneficiaries were, of course, the people who owned the bar, but they were also the cops, the politicians, or any other people who co-owned the bar with them. What's interesting is that one of the reasons the young women refused to believe that the bars would shut down, they actually thought this was some sort of elaborate hoax that was being played out, was because of the involvement of cops and politicians. But this was one of those circumstances where, you know, one group of politicians who actually had no involvement in the dance bars decided to shut them down. And the other politicians who were involved couldn't afford to openly associate themselves with the dance bar. So when it came time to pass this ban on the dance bars, everybody, all the political leaders of various political parties banded together and agreed that they should be banned. That the dance bars should be banned, because you know, in that particular culture, it's easier to be seen as standing in the way of somebody's human rights than it is to be seen as immoral.
What was your purpose when you started looking into dance bars, and how did that purpose evolve over the 5 years you spent researching this book?
So initially, I wanted to write a profile of the dance bars through Leela, but within a few months of, you know, doggedly tailing her, the government came up with this incredible, you know, decision to shut the dance bars down. So I was actually around and had this ringside view when Leela was kicked out of the dance bar and when the whole downward spiral started. And to me, it was such an incredible act of violence against these young women that I felt should be chronicled and not forgotten. And that's why I went from writing a report to writing this book.
Sonia also provides insight into the recent social uprising around women and violence in India. She describes the incident which sparked the outrage, a brutal kidnapping, rape, and murder case.
Yes, so the incident that you talk about occurred in December when a young woman, you know, a physiotherapy student, was returning home after watching the film. She was watching Life of Pi with a friend of hers, and it was a little past 10 p.m., and they boarded a bus that they assumed was a public bus. And once they were inside, the young woman and her friend were separated. He was beaten. She was gang raped and, you know, mutilated with an iron rod. Then she and her friend were stripped, and they were both thrown out into the road with the intention that the bus driver would run them over before escaping. That didn't happen. Both of them survived. The young woman, as everybody now knows, was taken to hospital, she and her her friend. She was eventually moved to Singapore, where she died just a few days later of her injuries. And this became one of those very rare cases that, you know, resulted in enormous uproar. I can't remember the last time that Indians have taken to the street to protest an act of sexual violence. But the protests were across the board, you know, young, there were students, there were activists, there were men, women, there were fathers who came with their daughters. And the protests were so intense, so determined, that the Indian media picked it up. And once the Indian media was talking relentlessly about it, it became an issue that everybody in the world was talking about, rightfully so. And it threw a lot of light over what has been a long-standing problem for women in India, which is, of course, the issue of rape, which is one, but really more to the point, which is sort of ceaseless sexual harassment that women suffer. And it also opened up questions, very probing questions about, you know, whether or not our judiciary is effective and whether our cops are doing their job. And the answers were, as we all know, very disappointing on many fronts. Of the six alleged rapists, one is believed to be a juvenile and will be tried in a juvenile court. What really makes that a cause for great anger is the news that that young man was the one who had cajoled the young woman and her friend to enter the bus. He had pretended to be a conductor. He had pretended to give them, he had given them tickets, which were, of course, fake tickets, because that was not an actual public bus. It was all an elaborate pretense to rape a woman, any woman who had stepped in. And apparently that young man was the most violent of all six alleged rapists. So this is another cause of, you know, considerable grief and anger for people right now, other than the fact that this is going to trial. So the Supreme Court has also passed certain recommendations for how the police and the judiciary should approach young women who come forward with reports of rape, and have also made amendments to the current rape law. It's very hard to say as of now what long-term impact the protests have had. They've certainly had significant short-term impact. And if nothing else, that's very heartening.
The Guardian reports that between December 16th and January 4th, there are 501 calls for harassment and 64 calls for rape recorded by the Delhi police, but only four are followed up on by further inquiries. Yeah. Why is there so little follow-up from the police? Is it that the police don't believe the victims, or is violence against women being condoned?
I think it's a variety of different things, and I'll try to tell you what's happening on both sides. So on one side, you have these young women who, first of all, are used to various forms of sexual harassment, you know, pinching, poking, touching. It's just become a part of daily life in some places in India. So number one, because these women think it's part of daily life, they don't report it. If you're not going to report a crime that the perpetrator doesn't get caught, he continues perpetuating those crimes, and generally the crimes become greater and greater. For example, in Delhi, there was a study that was conducted several years ago after another high-profile rape in a parking lot. The statistics show that a man in Delhi will commit 10 to 11 rapes before he's ever caught. And this would be one reason why, that the rapes do not get reported. But young women who report rapes complain that when they go to the police station, the police are disinterested in recording their rapes, dissuade them from giving a statement, and humiliate them and harass them. And there have also been cases of young women who get molested in police stations. So obviously, when we move to the next level, we find that, first of all, the cops don't seem to know how to behave under these circumstances, number one. And number two, there are no repercussions for their behavior. And so we reach the second hurdle. Then there's a third hurdle. If the case does go to court, because of the enormous amount of cases that are already in court, I mean, we have far fewer judges and functional courtrooms than we have cases that are coming to them. And the slow pace of investigation, it can take up to a decade for a victim to receive any sort of resolution in her case. And what happens in the majority of circumstances is that this young woman is so fed up of the harassment and the humiliation and the trauma of having to go back and forth between her house and the courtroom that she asks that all charges be dropped. And so we're back to square one, which is that the perpetrator suffers no consequences. He's back on the street to do whatever he wants. And now the other side of this is, outside of the coin, is that cops complain, you know, there's nothing in their training to help them bridge the gap between their experience of, say, growing up in the village where women lead very conservative lives and don't have these sort of concerns or challenges, and coming to the cities where obviously women are very different and do have these concerns and challenges. So the cops have no training. They really don't know what to do. And then there's stories of cops who don't get paid on time, and there's stories of cops who get, who are drawn into various forms of corruption, cops who say things like, you know, I wanted to follow up on her case, but there wasn't gas in my tank. I mean, I couldn't drive to the place where I was supposed to investigate. So it just goes so much deeper than just saying, well, the cops don't care. So which is why, you know, something like this has to be dealt with very thoughtfully and at many levels. There's just not one solution. So it will not suffice to say, well, we have tweaked the rape law and now everything will be okay. It does not suffice to say, well, now we've told our cops that they have to record every incident of rape. It's obviously going to take various things. It's not just recording the rape, it's investigating it, and so on and so forth. One of the things I do think that's very important and that I hope is going to happen is that rape cases are tried in fast-track courts, which means that they will just keep, the case will continue to be tried every single working day until a resolution is received. That is going to make a big difference in, I think, women just thinking about whether they want to go to court or not.
So there have also been a lot of public protests. Do you know if new media like Facebook or other things have been instrumental in helping people organize?
Yes, definitely. The majority of people in India, and in fact most other countries in the world, are not on Twitter and Facebook. We seem to think that everybody is because we and our immediate social group and our peers are, but that's not true. It certainly played a very important role in getting a certain kind of person onto the streets. And that's also been very important because we're talking about middle class and upper middle class people who have in India at least traditionally not participated in public protests, believing that, you know, that is sort of dirty work that lower classes can do or these activists can do. So in getting the middle and members of the upper class out in the streets, it's been huge.
There have also been protests internationally in Bangladesh, Pakistan, Nepal, Sri Lanka. So what is it about the Indian case that resonates in these countries as well?
You know, I don't know why particularly, except to say that the struggles and then the courage of one group of people in fighting something like this inevitably inspires other people. You know, that's what happened with the Arab Spring. It was one group of people that starts to say enough, and everybody else is inspired to fight for what turns out to be a common cause. And I think, actually, if you ask me what is the best thing that could come out of this across the board, not just in India, it would be that other people realize that the world right now is an incredibly violent place for women everywhere. There is no community, sadly, that is safe. I mean, even the statistics coming out of the U.S. are petrifying. And so the best thing that we can learn from this is to not comfort ourselves with the false truth that, well, things like this only happen in India or other developing countries, but to look within our own communities and to make sure that the situation doesn't devolve. That's really the best thing that can happen.
Sonia Filiaro, thanks very much for talking with me today.
Thank you.
For APA Compass, I'm Andrew Yeh.
You're listening to APA Compass on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. I'm Sari Gametta. Today I'm chatting with documentary filmmaker and professor of women's studies, Patty Duncan. Patty's current research focuses on the long-term effects of militarism and war on women in Asia and the Pacific. She is author of the book Tell the Silence, Asian American Women Writers and the Politics of Speech. Patty is also a member of the APA Compass Collective. Academia is not the only part of her life. She wrote and produced the documentary Finding Face with her partner Sky Fitzgerald. This film explores acid violence against women in Cambodia as a gendered form of violence, specifically the story of Tet Marina. This film has been featured at a number of festivals and won the award for Best Film at the Astoria International Film Festival, as well as Best Documentary Feature at the San Diego Asian Film Festival last year. The viewership of this film has just reached 30 million people across public television in the U.S. alone. Welcome back to the show, Patty.
Thank you, Rika. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. For our listeners who are a little unfamiliar, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Well, so at Oregon State University, and I had the opportunity to, and I also wrote the script for the film. So some of my research focuses on issues of militarism and war on women in Asia and the Pacific, and I became interested in these issues quite a while ago, stemming from learning about my mother's history and some of the experiences that she had as a woman growing up in South Korea, living and working near U.S. soldiers were stationed. And my father actually was in the U.S. military and was stationed in South Korea. That's where they met. And I was very interested in learning about their history and the social, political, economic context that shaped this relationship between the U.S. and South Korea and continues to really shape the experiences of women in Korea.
It's a really fascinating history. I guess we'll switch to your film. Tell me about Tet Marina and how you learned about her.
Tet Marina is a woman living on the East Coast in the U.S. today. When she was a teenager in Cambodia, she was discovered by karaoke music producers when she was pretty young. And she quickly became kind of a rising star in the karaoke music scene in Cambodia. And so she was acting in music videos and was sort of becoming recognized across the country. And when she was 15 years old, she was coerced into a relationship with a man named Sai Sita, who was the Undersecretary of State for Cambodia. And it quickly turned into a fairly abusive relationship that she tried to leave several times and could not because of the threats made against her and members of her family. So in 1999, when she was only 16 years old, she was brutally attacked with acid by Sai Sita's wife, Khun Sopal, in a very public marketplace in Phnom Penh. She was disfigured in this attack, and nothing was ever done to her attackers.
When you say nothing, there was no police intervention, nothing was brought to courts?
Yeah, nothing was brought to court. The arrest warrant somehow disappeared, even though there were hundreds of witnesses. Everybody knew who had perpetrated the attack against Tet Marina. Because of the status, nothing was done to basically hold her accountable for this attack. And so this impunity surrounding Tet Marina's attack, many human rights workers have suggested, led to a number of copycat attacks because people started seeing that one could get away with throwing acid in that context if the perpetrator had more power than the victim. So in the year following Marina's attack, there were numerous documented attacks.
This is a really incredible and sad story. At what point did you decide to develop her story and make this film?
Well, it was several years ago that we started working on this film with
Skye Fitzgerald, who has a lot more filmmaking experience than I do. We were in Cambodia, and we started learning about the issue of acid violence. I had done some research. We were thinking of doing kind of a short film that would be a useful read that local human rights workers, local organizers could use, because we felt that we had the time and the resources at that time to make kind of a short piece that could address this issue, which we were told repeatedly needed more visibility, more awareness. So we started doing interviews with survivors of acid attacks and working to organize against it, human rights workers, medical professionals, social services people as well. What we found was that almost everyone we spoke with mentioned the case of Tet Marina. And everyone just kept referring to Tet Marina's story because it was kind of a turning point in national consciousness around impunity and acid violence and women and gender. The more that we learned, the more we started to think, well, we need to incorporate the story of Marina. So when we came back to the U.S., I had learned a little bit about her story. I knew that she had been granted juvenile asylum to enter the U.S. after her attack, and that she'd been treated at the Shriners Children's Hospital in Boston for the burns on her face and body, because she was burned over, I think, about 40% of her body. So we found Marina, and we started a conversation with her about what we were doing. At first, she did not want to be involved in it. It turned out that she feared retaliation. She was also afraid for her family members still in Cambodia at the time. So, you know, she wasn't really that interested in participating in a film about this. So we considered just scrapping the whole project, because it seems like it would be a hard film, a hard issue to make a film about if we didn't include her story, but we don't want to in any danger or if it would make her uncomfortable. So we were kind of trying to figure out what to do at that point. A few weeks later, she wanted to meet, and she wanted to do this film.
That's incredible. And she contacted you again.
Yeah. She reached out. She'd been thinking about it, and this really shattered her. It disfigured her. She had to leave her family, her country, her culture. You know, she ended up in the U.S. very, very isolated and lonely for quite a while, and had to learn a new language, had to learn to live with a different face after, you know, undergoing more than 25 surgeries. So we knew that she had been through hell, and we certainly didn't make that any more difficult for her. And so we were thinking, you know, maybe we just won't do this project. And then she called us. She wanted the world to know what happened. She also felt that if there was any way that her speaking out against the injustice of acid violence to stop future attacks, that she wanted to try to do that. So we made arrangements to go to the East Coast and to meet her right away. And that was the beginning of the relationship that we've had with her for the last several years of getting to know her. And then we started producing the film in collaboration with her and with her older brother, Sekwondo, who was instrumental in getting her to the U.S. for medical treatment.
This was such an involved project. I imagine there were many difficult points for all of you involved in making this film. What do you feel was the most difficult point for you?
Oh, it was difficult trying to shape the story of Marina's experience and to shape the story, I guess, the larger story of the issue of acid violence against women the way that she would want her story told, you know. But we were also concerned about shaping a story that would not put her in any danger or her family members in any danger. We also felt that this not simply tell a story of survivors as victims, but as incredibly strong individuals who, in Marina's case, have an amazing analysis of the social issues surrounding acid attacks and, you know, have been able to forward through work to stop acid violence.
That is really brave of her, of all of you, really. How has the response of your film been from Cambodia?
Quite a lot of response, actually. We know that the film has been made available in the so-called black market.
That is to be expected in some parts of the world.
Yeah, we're thrilled about. Because, I mean, we actually hoped it happened, and we've been told by friends who have been to Russia in Phnom Penh, which is like a big public market, that copies are wide available there and sellable and accessible to people in Cambodia. Many people across the country, they knew about Marina's story and wondered what happened to her. There was a lot of curiosity. I think that as of late, we feel that there's been a lot of public support within Cambodia at the same time that there's been some anxiety or anger from the government about this issue. And we've also done a lot of work with Marina so that her family members in Cambodia were able to leave the country before this film was released.
For those of you who are just tuning in, you're listening to APA Compass on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. I'm chatting with documentary filmmaker and professor of women's studies, Patty Duncan. You mentioned before that you've been asked to not return back to Cambodia. Have there been any developments with the government intervening with violence against women or even an international response? Cambodia is not the only country that partakes in this kind of violence.
So it seems that there has been some interest in the film outside of the U.S. It's been shown on public television, national television in Australia, in Denmark, and in Poland. It's been shown at film festivals outside of the U.S. It premiered in Switzerland at the International Film Festival and Forum for Human Rights. And so we hope that it's having some kind of impact across the world, of course.
I think you're saying that it's like one drop in the bucket, except actually it's more like 30 million in our country alone.
Well, I hope, yeah. Last year, there was a law drafted against acid attacks. And that was the first law to be drafted to actually explicitly name acid attacks. And we're waiting, I think, to see what's going to happen. I need to learn more about how that is shaping up. But I think it's interesting that there has been a lot more attention and awareness around the issue of acid violence. I don't want to suggest that that's simply about our film. I think it's also about the amazing work that local organizers and activists have been doing for quite a long time there.
That's really great. That's a huge step forward. And definitely we'll all stay tuned to see what happens with that drafted law. I just want to switch gears a little bit, specifically to Tet Marina. We've learned about her past. How is she doing now? What is her current story?
Her current story is that she had another child recently. She is doing really well and really happy. I think that she's doing a lot better than she was in the past. And I think speaking out against this issue and also being recognized by people as someone who is working with injustice has been very important for her.
That's fantastic news. What was it like for Marina and her family to watch the film?
Oh, I think it was very hard. I think that it was probably really difficult for Marina to watch the film. We set up a private screening, the version that we had been working on, to Marina and her brother, Secundo, to be able to watch it alone with us. to be able to talk about it or ask questions, tell us if there were cases of it that they didn't want included or they didn't feel were accurate. So that was a very hard experience. She is one of the most courageous people I've ever encountered.
What was it like for you watching the film in the audience at your first festival?
That was in Geneva at the International Film Festival and Forum for Human Rights. And I was very, very nervous and excited. At that time, we had been working with several organizations and individuals to try to ensure the safety of Marina's family before the film showed. So I was thinking about them more than the screening, and thinking about, you know, the impact for Marina and for her family members, and thinking that everything was just about to change because for so many years she had felt very silenced, and here she was putting her story out there. So it was exciting and terrifying at the same time.
Patty, thank you so much for taking time out of your very busy week to chat with me.
Thank you, Sarika.
You're listening to APA Compass on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. I've been chatting with Patty Duncan, writer and producer of the documentary film Finding Face. You can learn more about the film at findingface.org. A podcast of this interview can be found after this broadcast on our website at kboo.fm/APA Compass.
Thanks again for listening to APA Compass. I'm Kushlani D'Souza, and in recognition of International Women's Day, our show today focuses on the difficult and important topic of gendered violence. I do want to let listeners know that our topics today could be triggering for survivors of violence or their advocates. Joining me today to discuss the media coverage of recent highly publicized cases of rape in India is Smith College Professor Pinky Hota, an anthropologist of South Asia who studies the anthropology of the body, of post-colonialism, and of knowledge production, among other things. Professor Hota, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Let's start with one of the headlines that has really helped fuel a conversation, not about this case itself, but about the media coverage surrounding it. Here's the headline from January 1st in The Australian, a newspaper out of Sydney. Mm-hmm. Gang rape shame could drag India into the 21st century. What do you see going on there? Is this characteristic of how many international news organizations have approached this story?
I think, unfortunately, that there has been a general impulse in which even the most culturally sensitive publications have portrayed this problem as a sign of the inherent violent nature of South Asia and a sign of its barriers to achieving modernity and the way that South Asia is consistently figured as still engaging in barbaric practices. But this kind of reportage is actually in keeping with a long tradition, a longer history in which women's issues have long provided the entry point for outside criticism, be it colonial cultures or Western human rights discourses.
Sure, we certainly have seen conversations about women's rights used to excuse all kinds of interventions from the West, right? We just have to look at U.S. involvement in Iraq and Afghanistan to see that.
Yeah, that's precisely right. And this is a function of how a kind of us and them thinking that extends across two levels. One is the international arena versus India, and then even within India, urban population versus a rural population. In the international arena, this just us and them thinking promotes headlines like these that say, well, violence against women is a South Asian problem rather than a global problem. This preserves an idea of the West as somehow not engaging in violence against women and more benevolent, and that gendered violence is not as much a Western problem as it is a South Asian problem. And similarly, in India, because this happened within the urban perimeter of Delhi and the perpetrators happened to be lower class, that this kind of us and them thinking has led people to say, well, this is a problem of the rural migrants to the city, and there too, the us and them thinking exempts people from examining their own selves and displacing the problem onto the other.
So I wonder if you see the possibility of, at some point, moving beyond that us and them.
Well, I think that this is not a phenomenon particular to South Asia, but I have to say that in India, the protest politics that has played out in this particular moment, I see some possibilities of a united protest public being formed, because there were people who came out from all strata society. There were men and women, there was very traditional housewives to working women to young students, and there was an occupation of the streets of the public sphere by many different sections of society. And for a few moments, it did feel like there was immense possibility of a unified protest public emerging from that moment. And particularly across women, where even women who normally would not be associated with any kind of formalized project of feminism, because, you know, India still, not only is feminism a highly elite construct, but is also seen alien to local ways of thinking. But, you know, women came out in support across strata, in support of the issue, which cut across class boundaries and caste boundaries and various socioeconomic boundaries. So I think that I do see this moment as having a possibility of unification.
Many media critics have pointed out that these recent cases in India tend to generate a lot more attention than similarly horrific cases in the United States. One in particular that has been compared is the Steubenville, Ohio case, in where players from the local high school football team are accused of literally dragging an unconscious and possibly drugged 16-year-old from party to party, where she was sexually abused in front of dozens of witnesses. And I wonder, what do you make of this comparison? Why have we heard so little about what happened in Steubenville, Ohio, and so much about what happened in Delhi?
I think, unfortunately, it plays into a kind of spectacle of what we imagine to be the kind of worst about particular cultures. And again, I think it's easier to train our lens elsewhere and to contemplate how an entire culture may be diseased, as long as we are not talking about our own culture. So because of the availability of new forms of social media, news in short time periods, there's a way in which that there also the media spectacle of minute-by-minute coverage that was not possible earlier is playing into that. People's watch wrapped with attention, whereas it's much harder to diagnose one's own culture as being violent to women, and also to contemplate how change could begin at home. Has the Indian case just revived interest in the issue so that we can all start contemplating rape as a global problem, as a larger symptom of oppression of women and violence against women, rather than being a problem of South Asia itself?
Are there other examples of rape culture here in the United States that you hear from your students, or that you use to globalize the problem of sexual violence rather than focus it as an Indian problem?
That's an excellent question, because just the other day when we were having a discussion about it, we were talking about the idea of victim blame, which is what a lot of Indian feminists have been talking about. The fact is that women in India have now become thoroughly accepted as modern workers, But apart from occupying the kind of public space as a worker, they're expected to retreat into the confines of their home. And when they do not, they are blamed for not being vigilant about their own security and endangering themselves or acting in reckless ways. And so we were talking about ways in which women are seen as behaving recklessly in the public, including the clothes that they wear, to going out with men. In this particular incident that happened in Delhi, she was out with a man, which was seen as kind of inviting negative attention and implicating her in kind of morally loaded ideas about why she was out at night with a man, etc. And my students pointed out that victim blame happened in the United States all the time, that people would talk about things about, well, why was she out with several men? Why was she drinking? And that in no circumstances, even if you had male friends over at your house at late hours in the night, or if you had been drinking, that should in no way explain rape. But my students were quick to point that there were certain universals in the way victims were constructed, be it in South Asia or in the United States.
One of the things that I noticed in some of the international media coverage of this case is sometimes the opposite of victim blaming. There's this desire to discuss all of her positive characteristics. She was a student. She was working to help support her family. And those things are true. But sometimes I wonder if, while I'm glad that we're not victim blaming, if the Western media, if they're really trying to tell us, but she wasn't bad, right? She didn't deserve this. Unlike, you know, someone who might be not a student or lazy or immoral or something.
That's a great point, and that was yet another thing that came up, where students really wanted to know, why is it that there was so much elaboration of the fact that she was a very driven student, that she wanted to bring her family out of poverty, and that, you know, in some ways she was a model of India's neoliberal aspirations, where individual achievement and hard work and education was people's ticket out of grinding poverty. And this was a kind of thwarting of that dream. Also, there have been other disturbing developments in India which really lead you to think about the way in which depictions of sympathy make you think about who really matters to the nation and who matters in terms of who we come to care about and who we feel more for or who we feel at all for. Because when I was in India a few months ago, people would often take out their smartphones or their computers and show me a picture of the alleged victim and a kind of picture of her smiling and a picture of her in bandages in the hospital. But I soon realized that those pictures were not of the victim at all, that they were these pictures which were doctored and had been circulating widely in the Indian media and across social platforms. And the reason that this was particularly disturbing was that this girl in the picture was light-skinned, good-looking, had the distinct aesthetics of a middle-class, attractive girl. And there was a sense that was the figure that could marshal the most sympathy. That was the figure that we could care about. But actually, the real victim perhaps was not, you know, a middle-class, light-skinned, upper-caste person, but was perhaps, in fact, darker skinned, not aesthetically pleasing, but it was this idea of how to construct a figure that would elicit sympathy, and in how that revealed who we care about and what counts as a person worthy of being cared about by the Indian nation. So that was disturbing, but we used that opportunity to kind of think about what are these ideas that rise to the top and what the nation cares about. It cares about progress, it cares about hard work, it cares about upward mobility, it cares about aesthetics, it cares about class and caste and bodily presentation. And so, yes, we did come to, this is very much, like you pointed out, on the opposite of victim blaming. It was kind of constructing a kind of false figure of the victim, which we could find most of feeling for in some sense.
Now, this is something that we do in the United States all the time. One example that jumps into my mind is the media coverage of the horrific Newtown shooting, which got so much attention because the faces of those white middle-class children represent a group that in America is identified as inherently good. We saw in their heartbreaking school photos the representation of, as you say, bodies that matter. White, middle-class children whose deaths were grieved by the entire nation and actually started a national conversation about gun violence and gun control. But the faces of dozens of African-American young people who have been killed in an epidemic of gun violence in Chicago, these victims haven't elicited the same kind of national outcry. What we're not saying is America doesn't read their bodies and faces as having the same worth as the children of Newtown.
Exactly.
We've been talking about how not to suggest that violence is not an Indian cultural problem. But on the other hand, some critics have pointed out that some media sources are minimizing the problem of rape in India by making these exact comparisons. I was reading British blogger Sunny Hundle, who criticized a liberal Guardian newspaper for manipulating statistics to suggest that reporting rates of rape and conviction rates in rape cases in India are on par with Britain's, when in fact they are considerably lower. And he says, you know, this is patronizing. It's this attitude of it's just as bad in the West is actually unfair in ways to the Indian women who are protesting rape culture that's specific to India.
I absolutely agree, because there is a fine line to be tread here. On the one hand, one wants to contemplate gendered violence as a global problem. On the other hand, it would be equally analytically lazy and inaccurate to say that there is nothing about this that is being perpetuated by particular Indian attitudes towards women or culturally salient practices. And as an anthropologist, I've particularly struggled with this because, you know, the mantra of anthropology in some sense is to evaluate each culture on its own terms and to engage in a kind of cultural relativism. Each culture should be appraised relative to its own standards. But having said that, there are certain issues that feed into the problem. For example, the fact that Indian women have been thought of as so closely identified with the family and the honor of the family, that stigma associated with rape is so much higher in India. Now, this leads to not only a kind of enduring social shame, but also leads to underreporting of rape. And this is a very valid cultural construct. There are also ideas that women are accountable to the male figures in their family. And so in some sense, women are constructed from the get-go as figures to be paternally taken care of, both at home and outside. So in some sense, a woman is never really fully seen as responsible for her own security and her own body. It's very much a kind of family property. We risk, in our effort to say this is a problem the world over, we risk neglecting the particulars of the Indian case. What I've encouraged my students to do is both to kind of attend to the particulars, but also continue to think about what are the kind of larger global parallels to be drawn here.
So as you describe some of these ideological components of rape culture, women being seen as property, as representative of their family honor, as lacking control over their own bodies. Now, these things are true across patriarchal cultures, certainly here in the United States. And I see your point about needing to talk about the specific ways that these ideas are manifested in various cultures, in this case, India. What do you think about some critics' beliefs that we in the West have this idea of a superior record on women's rights, but that in many ways is a luxury paid for by colonialist exploitation of nations like India?
Well, I certainly do think that there are links to be made with colonialism insofar as how the West has traditionally constructed other places as uncivilized and as needing to be fixed. And women's issues were a kind of prominent gateway through which cultures were diagnosed as needing to be fixed and Gayatri Spivak, a prominent feminist, is known for saying the project of colonialism was in large part about white men saving brown women from brown men. However, I think that the political economy of colonialism was more complicated in that, and certainly colonial regimes were not great to women, both of their own cultures and to the cultures that they were entering. I think the ideas to talk about when we're talking about the funding of women's rights is that it just happens that the global north has considerably larger resources. This has been accrued through, a history of imperialism, but also in equal part through a long-standing model of capitalism. And so in some ways, the state wealth that is available to allocate towards women's issues is entirely of different proportions. Now, having said that, the Indian government today announced a very large sum of money to address women's issues. So I think that even though people might try to claim that economic inequities are the reason why there are inequities in attention to women's issues, it's not a simple matter of economics. In whatever context, be it the global north or the global south, far more resources could be allocated to women's issues. And if we were to look at comparative breakdowns, we would see that women's issues are being underfunded both in the global north and the global south. So it's all about making women's issues a priority. Now, even as I say that, I'm thinking about the Indian government's Women and Children Department. And both these categories are always constructed as needing extra help, but yet consistently these remain the most vulnerable populations. So I think maybe it's time that these special categories should not be constructed as not in charge of their own security, and if we could somehow increase the visibility to violence against women and children, then I think that that's where my politics would lie.
Now that the trial is underway for five of the men accused in this Delhi rape incident, I wonder, what do you see or hope for in the wake of the trial?
This has been a moment, unfortunately, of great sadness, but this is a moment in which men are accountable for the kinds of masculinities they have been inhabiting. This is a moment in which governments are being called into question by women. This is a moment in which women's issues may actually get exposed to a much wider public. So I would like for people to consider that this moment has political possibilities.
Well, Pinky Hota, thank you very much for being with us today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to APA Compass, the Pacific Northwest's only Asian Pacific American public affairs radio program, and thanks to all of our guests today. APA Compass airs at 9 a.m. on the first Friday of every month and is collectively produced by Andrew Yeh, Sarika Mehta, and Kushlani D'Souza. You can download segments of this and other shows at our website, kboo.fm/APA Compass. If you have a story idea or want to pitch an idea for an Angry APA Minute, please leave us a message on our Facebook page, APA Compass Radio.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Friday, March 1st, 2013, and you're listening to KBOO, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. Well, this morning, news from the grand jury resistors and the Bill of Rights Defense Committee's own Nadia Kale is joining us with reflections on this week's historic San Francisco vote against the NDAA. That's the National Defense Authorization Act. That is, in a nutshell, military detention within the United States for you and I and everybody else we know. And Harvey Wasserman is back with us this morning to tell a story and talk a little bit about why the Obama administration's dubious embrace of nuclear energy is so ill-advised, and now is the time to take a stand and oppose it. We may not have another opportunity in many cases. The weather, though, first for today, scattered sprinkles, partly sunny, highs near 64. It's going to be a warm one, though overcast, a little bit breezy, medium winds around 8 miles per hour. Tonight, patchy fog moving in after 10, and cloudy, lows around 47 for tomorrow. Rain, and that's probably going to get rolling in later in the afternoon, highs near 56. And again, that medium sort of a gentle south-southeast wind driving it all. Saturday night, wet and lows around 42. Sunday, there's a mild chance of showers, probably starting out the day, otherwise partly sunny with a high near 50, calm winds, and Sunday night partly cloudy with a low around 38, bringing us full circle to Monday morning. We're going to forego the alternative forecast. You're on your own, Lunar Gardeners, because we have guests today, and we want to hear from them right away. First off, we're going to be speaking with Chris Marcusano. Chris is with the Resistor Grand Jury. I think many listeners may not be clear on what exactly it means to be called before a grand jury to testify. It's terrifying, it's lonely, and it's dangerous. And a number of young people have been courageous in taking a stand for what they believe in. And we're very pleased to welcome Chris to the KBOO airwaves this morning. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, I'm really glad that you're here. Briefly, because, you know, this is a short program, could you just let listeners know why a grand jury summons is such a dangerous thing?
Sure. So grand juries are held completely in secret. It's closed to the public, so there is no public